Welcome to the Business Podcast, where we interview professionals across all industries.
Hey, it's Simon. Welcome back. Today we have Aaron Tate Wimberly, an international expert in business and finance, who's also involved in various leadership committees across some of the top global nonprofits. Aaron, it's great to have you with us today. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me today, Aaron.
Absolutely. Kick us off, Aaron. Tell us a little bit about yourself and share something that most people might not know about you.
Yeah, so my profession is I'm a managing director of an investment bank called Madison Street Capital. We're a middle market investment bank. And really, it's kind of my calling. What I realized is doing finance or investment banking, you need to be very specialized, not only in business, how businesses operate, but also how to best get the correct financing for some of those businesses. As you mentioned, I do quite a bit of volunteer work in my free time. And one thing that people may not know about me, this is kind of a personal detail. My father is an educator, but at the start of the pandemic, he turned me on to this whole philosophy that really became central to how I operate on a daily basis. It's a philosophy called Stoicism. And really, it's been a lifesaver where most people have really gotten kind of held up or frozen during the pandemic. But it's really allowed me to go about my days and actually accomplish more during a period where it's been very difficult for a lot of people. So for the past 2 years, I've been a firm practicer of Stoicism, and it's really helped me out as a philosophy. So,
well, congrats on your success. And it's interesting that you mentioned Stoicism. You might also be interested in, if you're not familiar with it, the concept of flow by a gentleman by the name of Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And I think those two mesh really nicely, especially in today's day and age where that separation we have allows us to really focus more deeply on our areas of expertise. But with that in mind, Aaron, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you got your career start and walk us through that journey up until what you're doing now.
Yeah, sure. So I did my undergraduate at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is kind of a hub for banking and finance. So naturally, when I graduated, I came back and really wanted to get into the world of investment banking. So I started my career doing securitizations, investment banking, mergers and acquisitions. And the group I was with, we were some of the first to package multi-billion dollar auto loan and home equity loan securitization packages. Great start to my career, but honestly, my undergraduate was in a liberal art, which is international relations. So I realized very quickly that I did need to develop some core fundamental skills in business and finance. So yeah, I've kind of taking you along the career progression. I've held various jobs, including legal and compliance. I've worked for Yum Restaurants Incorporated, which is the parent company for Pizza Hut, KFC, and Taco Bell. And really, around 2014, I realized that finance was my calling. So I decided to pursue a second master's of finance. And it really gave me the tools for building financial models, evaluating companies, doing some basic skill sets in finance. And since then, I've been essentially an investment banker. And to keep that simple, that's really just helping business owners make some key decisions for their businesses. What's going to help me thrive as a business owner? What is going to prove to be sustainable for making sure this business is one of the top competitors in the industry? And what kind of financial solutions are going to make that happen? So really, that's kind of where I've come full circle today. I am an investment banker, and really that means I'm a servant to whatever client I work on behalf of in terms of getting them the financing or solutions that they need for their business.
So it's interesting that you spoke about earlier the idea of specialization. And when it comes to investment banking, a lot of the boutiques tend to have a track record in a certain industry or industry verticals. So maybe you can talk a little bit about where your expertise lands with that in mind.
Yeah, so let me give you a little bit of a backstory. So my first career was with Wachovia Securities, which now is part of the entity for Wells Fargo. At the time, there was a firm in Charlotte called Bowles Hollowell Connor. It was a boutique. It was the number one M&A shop in the U.S. It became acquired by Wachovia Securities. And really what happened with that acquisition is Bowles Hollowell had some very specialized bankers that could also work across industries. So they were essentially generalists. When they became a part of Wachovia Securities, they wanted to put the bankers into silos where they just focus on one particular industry. As a result of that, some of the bankers felt like they lost a little bit of the freedom to kind of go across sectors or companies. So throughout my career, I've kind of kept that in mind and said to myself, well, you need to be both a specialist, an expert, and a generalist. So the reason I mention that is because there are certain industries where I can definitely do a deep dive and provide a great deal of specialization. But I've also realized that you have to know if there's something that's relevant in business and finance, you have to become a master of that subject very quickly to stay up with today's economy. So it's a good question. I would consider myself a generalist, but I do have some specific industry specialization.
Great. Maybe you can talk about that industry specialization a bit more.
Yeah. So I mentioned I worked for a couple of years with Yum Restaurants. At the time, it was the number one franchise restaurant in the world in terms of number of locations. A part of that was really learning the business unit economics of individual locations, what drives new growth of the franchise business model, really how the franchise business expands. So that allowed me to have a really good specialization in franchising, the world of consumer food service, and really brick and mortar operations of restaurant chains. So that's something that's still valuable today, where a lot of times I meet kind of up and coming people that would like to grow their brand from a couple locations to maybe expand that to statewide or nationwide or even global international expansion plans. And just having had that experience with Yum, it gives me a certain sense of ease in knowing that, yeah, we can expand your business statewide, nationwide, and also help you with some of that international expansion, because I feel very specialized in the consumer food service business model. There's a couple other industries that I'm also well specialized in. I did some work as an equity research analyst covering broad lines and consumer staples. So that's pretty much the brands that fall into the Simon Property Group retail segment, brands like Abercrombie & Fitch, The Gap. And really, that's also a very good business to be specialized in. Retail has probably suffered the most during the pandemic, with people showing up to these locations less. So in terms of sectors with a rebound, it's got one of the greatest potentials that I see. So retail, broadlines, consumer food service, healthcare, those are three areas where I've got a pretty deep specialization.
So with that in mind, Aaron, maybe you can talk a little about what you see in terms of dynamics being affected by what's been happening globally, either in the positive or negative direction. What have you observed working on deals yourself and supporting your clientele?
Yeah, I've seen a couple things emerge. And these are business trends as well as larger social currents that are happening. So one of the things that the pandemic has done has moved the boundary between personal life and work life kind of away. It's good that people are working from home and able to do their jobs. But a lot of people have questioned, what is my place in the workforce going back to the office? So one of the things that a lot of people are talking about is this concept of the great resignation. And I think one thing that I think is really going to come as a result of the pandemic is kind of a shift where people can better determine what's a healthy work-life balance for them. Maybe it's I go to the office 4 days a week. Maybe it's a four-day work week. I think those are going to be much more flexible. The other thing that I think is a result of that is what I would call the emergence of a purpose-driven organization. I think the other thing that a lot of the people who left the workforce realized is they started to question, what is my personal tie to this company that I'm working for? So now you've seen corporations take a much more active role in corporate social responsibility, social equity, some social things that that perhaps give their employees a better sense of purpose. I not only work for this company, but this company is doing a social good. This company is doing an environmental good. So I think that's one thing that corporations are going to have to actively do is say, yes, we are a corporation making profits, but this is also a part of our purpose. We do good for the general population. We have this CSR program that really does a net social positive. So those are two trends that I would see as a result of what I'd call the great resignation. People being able to better negotiate their terms of how they provide their labor, as well as really this new demand for purpose-driven organizations.
And Aaron, when you think about how multiples have been infected, well, we can fix that in post. So let me repeat that a bit better. So Aaron, when you think about how multiples have been impacted by the pandemic, what are some interesting elements that you've seen from a private equity point of view or from a strategic buying point of view?
Yeah, so one thing about me is I try to be very, I would consider myself a contrarian, much like Warren Buffett. So I look for things that are really not popular, because by the time they reach a stage where they're very frothy and everybody is doing it, it's usually overvalued. So, and the reason I mention that with respect to multiples is one of the things that has happened over the past couple of years is this democratization of finance, where everybody is into things like NFTs, everybody's into things. One of the best examples is GameStop. GameStop really became kind of a flag bearer for everybody being able to be involved in finance. So the reason I mention that is because you have to be a little bit critical of what are the group dynamics doing, and is that causing an inflated set of multiples for valuations of these businesses? You have to look at What is the real valuation of the company versus any inflated value that this new powerful market is really enabling? So it varies across sector, but when you look at certain things such as crypto, such as SaaS, some of those companies that are always very popular, you have to cross-check your multiples, look at the DCFs, look at the precedent transactions, and really ask yourself, is this something that the market could support if this does go to market? So it's a long answer short. You have to be a little bit kind of critical thinking with respect to valuation multiples.
And you know, that's a very valid point, because I'm sure you've experienced in dealing with clients unrealistic expectations of where they really land on their value in comparison to the market realities. So maybe you can share a interesting scenario that you might have encountered in the past helping a client create a liquidity event, and maybe highlight some of the challenges that took place along that way.
Yeah, so this is the people side of finance. What you have to realize is these people have built this business. They put their own blood, sweat, and tears into it. And it's not just because it's fulfilling for them. It's because they think that, and they're correct in thinking, that they have created true value with what they've built. So the reason I mention that is because you almost have to act as if you're a mediator between what they expect, which a lot of times is very lofty, which is good, versus something a little bit more grounded in saying, okay, like this may be a more conservative valuation of your business, but it also shows that you've put quite a bit of diligence into the valuation process, and you've looked at the full valuation from a 360 perspective. And it may not be the lofty valuation that you were hoping for, but this is the reality of what we feel the market can offer your business. So really my role a lot of times is acting as a mediator to say, okay, we know you thought the valuation was this very high amount. We may be a little bit more prudent if we lower the valuation a little bit. And something that's not going to be too onerous on the business owner as well. So it's kind of a mediation process a lot of times.
That's certainly true. And I'm curious if you've ever had a scenario that you can speak about in more detail where you got past the due diligence process, you had an active offer on the table, and for whatever reason, things kind of fell apart unexpectedly.
Yeah, that's a good question too. And that's really touching into the full life cycle of what I do as an investment banker. It's not just going out and finding any potential investment in a business. No, it's sitting with the business owner and saying, like, all right, what is it that you prefer? What is the what are the different costs of capital with different types of financing going to do to the ownership of the business? What's it going to do to your long run plans with the business? So I get back to this word of fiduciary. I don't work for the market. I work on behalf as an agent of the business owner. So one of the things that's unique about our firm is we really sit down for 2 days before we ever engage with somebody to find out, all right, what is it that you want to do personally? Do you want to retire? Is there a liquidity event? Drill down to, okay, what is the business want to do? What is a reasonable expectation? Is it an IPO? Is it sale to a strategic or a financial? And really, once we answer all those questions, we act as a fiduciary to go out and execute that on behalf of the business owner. And really that is my core concern. It's not what the market says. It's really, if the business owner can say, you went out and it may not have been the terms that I wanted, but we do like these terms, then I've done my job.
And that's a great point that you make, because there are a lot of dynamics when looking at consummating a transaction. Maybe the owner at some point wanted to sell a portion of the company and then might have changed their mind and said they'd sell it all. That kind of digs into the topic of legacy and their concerns from staffing, if a strategic or if a financial buyer gets involved, how that's going to look. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your experiences there. What comes to mind in terms of the dynamics when they're thinking about legacy and keeping their staff happy as there is a transition?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And I don't know if I'll fully be able to answer that today, because it's a process that requires quite a bit of deliberation and saying, like, okay, these business owners have not only created this business, but they're also creating these jobs for their employees. So what happens structurally if they decide to transfer ownership, or if they decide to completely exit a business? What is in the best interest of the business? What is in the best interest of the shareholders and also the stakeholders? And the stakeholders would be the employees, people who are connected to that business in the community. So really, the best way to kind of look at that is through a 360 approach, where you do find out what it is that the legacy is of the business owner. And then you kind of mediate that process to say, we've done the analysis. This is what's going to happen structurally to your former employees, your current employees. We also have to look at maybe it's a family business and there's family ownership or family that's employed by the business. So those are additional legacy questions that we have to take a look at is, okay, this particular person is not going to be involved with the business any longer, but they have a relative who would like to take the ball and run with it. What can we do to support that next generation business owner to make sure it's a thriving business?
Yeah, and that's a good point, because sometimes it begs the question, is that person they intend to follow on and carry that legacy actually suited for the growth of the companies and to take it to the next level? Because oftentimes strategic buyers or financial buyers, they want someone with the track record of growing a company to that next level. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the challenges that arise at that point in time, if any, that you've encountered in your company life.
Yeah, it's really such a personal question. And this gets back to that, you could call it fiduciary responsibility or know your customer responsibility. We have to know what they want to do in advance of us approaching a strategic or approaching a financial, because each come with its own set of circumstances. Obviously, if it's a financial, it's more of a monetary, this is the value that I'm getting. If it's strategic, it could have a perspective of, okay, this business is closely aligned with what our business is doing. Are we a complement to their business? And is this initial investment going to lead to a potential acquisition of our business, a potential sale of equity stake? And there's so many questions that we have to check the box on that we have to engage with these CEOs and really act as their advisor before we even approach strategics or financials to know what's appropriate. And that's maybe one of the advantages of a boutique investment bank is just the level of detail that goes into having some of those preliminary conversations before it's ever reaching the market. I explained to somebody the difference between a big box like Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank and maybe a boutique is like if you're going to get a suit. I mean, essentially, if you go to a big box, it's just like going to a big box retailer a lot of times. You may get a good quality suit, but is it custom tailored? Does it fit in the right way? Is it something that's going to remain timeless or fashionable or for the long run? And that's kind of the benefit of a boutique is we are really going through the business with a fine-tooth comb, answering all those potential scenarios, and then presenting the best set of options or execution for that business owner.
Wonderful, Aaron. Well, it's been great getting insight from you around these myriad of questions. But if we switch gears a little bit and you had the opportunity to go back in time, meet with anyone in history, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an investor or financier. What comes to mind?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's probably changed throughout the years. I think at one point in time, I probably would have said Gandhi. At one point in time, I would have said Nelson Mandela. I think with my recent studies into Stoicism, the current answer of the day would probably be Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. He was a Roman emperor from, I think, around 160 to 180. And he was a Stoic philosopher, but really he was one of the five good emperors of Rome. And with my kind of journey into Stoicism during the pandemic, it's really been just a great way to manage. And somebody like that who had to manage this whole empire that just during a very difficult time would be just to get their insights on things would be an amazing opportunity to speak with somebody that I just have the utmost respect for.
Well, Aaron, once again, it's been a pleasure. And until we speak again, maybe you can share a parting thought.
Yeah. And I guess one of the things that I wanted to approach, tie this back to finance. One of the reasons Stoicism has been really enlightening for me is this. I think finance professionals, business owners, as well as especially risk managers, should kind of use this term as their modus operandi. It's a term in Stoicism called premeditatio malorum. And essentially what you're doing is you're kind of doing a thought process where you can think about any potential situation. What is the worst possible situation that can happen? What is the best possible situation that can happen? I think it's our responsibility, not as business owners and executives, not to be just putting out fires, but thinking ahead. What is the potential for this happening? What is the potential for that happening? If you get into more of a predictive mode instead of reacting to maybe putting out fires, it's just a better way to do business. And then you're never shocked when something happens. So that's one of the things I've been using quite frequently. And I think all risk professionals should be very familiar with that concept.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for your time, and it's always a pleasure.
Thanks for attending the Business Podcast, and stay tuned for more episodes.